You're listening to Popstar Conversations, taking you inside with your favorite musical artists.
Chuck and I are sitting here with the one and only Petula Clark. Welcome to our show.
Petula, it's so nice having you here with us. This album, From Now On, as short as this title is, it must be leading us somewhere.
Yes, I suppose it is, From Now On. Yes, but I think it's an important half a sentence. I certainly feel that really what matters is what happens from now on. You know, the past is the past. It's gone. You know, and I'm not a very nostalgic person anyway, unless I have to be, you know, for some specific reason. But I don't sit around thinking about the good old days at all, you know, because they weren't all good. You know, they never are. But I feel more sort of sure of myself now. I think I've got more of an idea of where I'm going, I think.
Well, with you, we're sure there's always more to come.
Hopefully there's more to come. And I'm very positive about what's happening in my life. I have a UK tour coming up, which I'm really excited about because I love being on tour, unlike so many of my comrades. They hate being on tour, and I absolutely love it. I don't do it often enough, maybe that's why. And a UK tour is never very long because the UK is very small. But I have my great band with me, my musical directors coming over from New York to take care of all that side of things, and we'll be off on the road. And the UK is a very beautiful country, and so I'll be traveling on the bus. So I'll see some nice countryside, meet some great people with unusual accents, Newcastle, Manchester, etc., you know, Glasgow. No, I'm really looking forward to it. I like touring.
You've been quoted as saying that when you do new songs, they're like love affairs. In what way?
Well, the new songs are always, they're fresh. And, you sort of are in love with them. It's a bit like a love affair. And you don't know enough about them yet, a bit like a love affair. And it's fascinating. And, of course, the really exciting thing and the scary thing is to present them to an audience because they know nothing about them. And so, you know, the tour is going to be a test. And I like that. I like going on stage being a bit scared.
You had done several other records in French. And your last album, Lost in You, that was your first English-speaking record in a very long time.
Yeah, well, we did it in the same studio. Lost in You was recorded in the same studio as this one. It's a tiny studio, about the quarter of the size of this room, about the size of a kitchen in a modern apartment, you know? And it's actually at the bottom of the garden. It's like a little hut. You know, it's like a little Wendy house. It's got windows. It doesn't look like a studio. And you walk in, and of course, it's a state-of-the-art studio. It's absolutely perfect. And the vocal mic where I sing is in front of a little window, and I can see trees and flowers and birds and a cat chasing the birds. I mean, it's not like any other studio I've ever worked in. And it's very, very effective. I like working there very much. And we write everything right there in the studio. It's not the way we used to make records.
What was the contrast between working in a small studio and of course working in the big studios that you did in the past?
There was something very exciting about walking into a big studio with 40 musicians waiting for you with orchestrations, and somebody says, okay, take one, and then whack, you hear this huge orchestra. I mean, that's pretty exciting. There's nothing quite like that energy that you get from a bunch of musicians really playing well and playing a great song for the first time. You know, the first time I heard Downtown played by an orchestra was in London Pye Studios, and it nearly knocked me over. I mean, it was very exciting. So you don't have that anymore.
What is it like this time in your life to be going so strong in your career? It doesn't seem like you're ever going to stop.
Well, I can't quite imagine it yet. You know, all the time my voice is functioning, and it is, and people want to come and see me, I can't really see the point in stopping. I mean, I'm enjoying it. You know, how many people can say that? So it's a privilege to go out and sing in front of an audience. That's the part that I like best, is live performance. So, yeah, so I go on doing it. But let me tell you, I'm very good at just hanging around and not doing anything. I can do that pretty well, you know.
You know, you've been performing and touring your whole entire life. How were you able to balance your personal life?
Well, that's that side of my life. You know, I also have three children, two grandchildren, too. So, you know, I can do other things. I can go for walks in the countryside. I can do a bit of shopping. I can do all that stuff. You know, I'm not... What I'm trying to say is that I'm not a showbiz person who sort of when she walks into a room, everything has to stop. And, you know, here I am, folks. I'm not that kind of person, you know. So I love my work, and I have great respect for it. You know, when I do it, I really work at it. You know, you ask my musicians, they know that I can be pretty tough in rehearsals. But the actual business of going out on stage is pure joy for me. Very relaxed, no script. I just go out and let the thing happen. The thing is what happens between a performer and an audience, and vice versa, because it's two-way traffic. So I'm getting a lot out of it too. So it becomes a kind of communion, and that's a great feeling.
When you were 11 years old, you performed at London's Royal Albert Hall. What was going through your mind at that time?
I was sitting reading a comic, and then somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Petula, you're on," you know. And I went out there, sang, absolutely pulled the place down, came back to my comic, you know, as if nothing had happened. It's not like that anymore.
Why did you select to cover the song Blackbird that was written by Paul McCartney?
Well, actually, I didn't pick it. It was chosen by the producer, John Williams, John O. Williams, not John Williams from Star Wars, etc. Well, you know, I'm often asked to do a Beatles song, and on the last album, I did a John Lennon song, which I did pick because it was my tribute to John, whom I loved very much. And then, you know, there are the obvious Beatles songs, you know, The Long and Winding Road, which is a great song, and blah, blah, you know, there are so many. And then he mentioned Blackbird, which you don't hear too often. And I listened to Paul's recording, and I said, yes, that's lovely, but it's, do you know what? It's really quite a complicated little song. You know, it keeps changing meter. Perhaps you're not aware of this, but I became aware of it when I started actually trying to sing it in front of the microphone, and I found myself having to count on my fingers. Oh, well, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But it's lovely. I adore it.
Can you give us some insight on how you ended up on the record Give Peace a Chance with John Lennon in Montreal?
It was a big problem, and I walked straight into it, you know, just as I had walked straight into the civil rights movement, you know, years before. Like an innocent walking into this. Anyway, John was very helpful, and he said, meh. Well, I can't tell you what he said. And then he said, come on. He said, you go and have a drink. And, you know, it was a suite, so there was a sitting room, and I went into the sitting room, and there were a lot of people there, Timothy Leary and one or two people I knew. But they were just hanging around, having a glass of wine, and there was some music going on, very simple music, and then they gave us somebody gave us all a lyric sheet so that we could sing along with this music, you know, with a glass of wine. And it was Give Peace a Chance. And so, you know, I sang along with everybody, and it was all being recorded. I didn't know that. So I am on Give Peace a Chance. You can't really hear me, but I'm there all right.
During the 60s, there was a whole scene in London going on called the Swinging 60s. Were you influenced by it?
I was on the outside. I mean, I knew what was going on, and sometimes I was on the edge of it, you know, because you couldn't avoid it. And I was also recording. I was living in Paris when that Swinging London thing was going on, but I was doing all my recordings in London, as everybody was, you know, Serge Gainsbourg and all those people. They were going to London to record because it was that much better. So, you know, I was spending a lot of time in London, but I didn't really get involved with all that madness, all that fun.
You did an incredible rendition of the song Fever. Were you a fan of Peggy Lee?
Yes. You know, when I was growing up, my idol was Peggy Lee. And I knew, you know, she made the most wonderful LP, do you remember those, of Black Coffee, which was my sort of Bible. I knew every word, every breath. I just loved it. So when years later I met her, I was kind of, you know, nervous, because it's always scary when you meet somebody that you've admired for so long. You know, are they going to be nice? Are they going to like me? Are they going to be really snobby? You know, but she was just wonderful. And we sang together, and we really enjoyed singing together, and we became friends. So when Fever came up, I thought, this is Peggy's song. You know, I don't want to do this. And then I had to leave the studio for a few hours to do something else. And I came back, and they had done, in the studio, they had done a track for me. You know, they're very sneaky people. And it's a totally different take on Fever. And so I thought, okay, I can sing this, and I think she'd like it. So we've done it.
Patola, back in the 60s, you appeared on several of the variety shows, and especially Dean Martin. You appeared on his show several times. What was it like working with Dean?
And he never liked to rehearse. Everybody else rehearsed except Dean, and he would turn up on the day of the taping of the television show, and most of the time he didn't even know who was in it, you know. And he always looked as if he was kind of tiddly, a little bit drunk, but he wasn't. He wasn't drunk. It's just he had no idea what was going on. And they had these big idiot cards, you know, with what he had to say, plus arrows saying, now you walk this way. And you know, but I loved him. I did the show many, many times, and he was just great. Very funny man. To my mind, much funnier than Jerry Lewis. That's just my sense of humor. Also, it used to be very, very carefully worked out. He had an amazing team around him. All those big television shows were teamwork. Brilliant.
You had done a lot of variety shows. Unfortunately, times have changed. You did that special with Harry Belafonte, and you caused quite a controversy just by touching his arm.
Oh, yeah. That's, I still can't quite believe the fuss that was made about that, because... You know, I was just honored to have Harry as my guest on this is my first NBC special in LA. And we rehearsed together for 3 weeks, and we got to know each other. We liked each other. I mean, we just laughed and had a great time. And when it came to taping day, we were doing this duet, a sort of anti-war song, which I had co-written, and he loved it, and I loved singing it with him. And we were standing side by side, and you know, and I just touched his arm during the performance, and we didn't know what had happened. But up in the control room, there's what they call a sponsor's room. And the sponsor was there, and he went insane when he saw me touching Harry's arm. He said, I'm not having my star touching a black man's arm. You know, we can't have this. You know, we have to do this all again. And so the director, you know, this is the sponsor, this is the guy who's putting the money in, you know. So he got us to do it in a different way. You know, he talked back to us and said, we'll just try this a little differently, Harry and Petula. You know, Harry, you stand over here and then Petula over there, and we're going to do a technical kind of thing. It'll look beautiful on the screen. Don't worry. And Harry, of course, knew what this was. I didn't. I was a total innocent. Anyway, we did that, and then that's three takes. Okay, and then the lights went out. This is a long story, I'm sorry, but if you want to know it, this is the story. Lights went out, and my husband, who was the executive producer, and our lawyer came down to the studio, and took me by the hand and said, come on. And we went downstairs into this, just underneath the studio, and there was this guy eating a sandwich, and he was there with the tapes. Everything that is recorded goes down into this room, and he keeps an eye on it all. And my lawyer said, you erase these two tapes. And the guy said, I can't do that. We have to keep everything just in case something goes wrong. He said, you know, that will be only one take left. And my lawyer said, this is an order. You erase those two takes. And he said, okay. And we watched him press the button, and he erased the two takes. So there was only one left, and that was the one where I touched Harry's arm. And that caused a huge hoo-ha. You know? And but you know, I came in from England. You know, I didn't know any about. Not that I didn't know, but to me it seemed so ridiculous. At the time, my musical director was black. Our choreographer was black. You know, what's the big deal? Anyway, times have changed.
Wow.
Could you please tell us a little about your collaboration with the iconic Charles Aznavour?
Yes, Charles asked me to do the music for this lyric, and I was a little intimidated, you know, because, you know, Aznavour is Aznavour, you know. And he said, oh, yes, you do it, you know. And so I did. And yes, that's me playing piano on it too. Yeah, it's nice. It's a beautiful song. I mean, for those of you who speak French, you will know that it's not just a pretty song. It's actually quite desperate.
When you moved to Paris, French was not your native language. How did you end up recording in French?
I went to France because I was in love with a Frenchman, but I couldn't speak French, and I had no intention of having a French career. I mean, why would I? I made this record in French because that was the only way that I could get close to this guy that I was in love with, because he was a PR man. I thought, well, if I make a record, I'll have to go to Paris, and then we'll get close, you know. But it was a terrible record. You know, I couldn't speak French, and there was more accent than language, you know. But the French fell in love with it. And that was the beginning of a career for me. And it just turned out to be, you know, how these things turn out in life. And I found myself learning about life in France, which is not bad.
You became an international artist. Can you give us some insight on how challenging it was to sing in French, Italian, German?
Oh, it was difficult. It was really hard. I found German really hard to do. I mean, I had to do it phonetically, because, I mean, if they put the lyrics in front of me, it was just like, it could have been Chinese, you know. And so what I did, somebody would recite it to me in German, obviously, and I would write what I heard, which, of course, didn't look anything like German, but it came out sounding like German, I think. I'm not quite sure. I used to find the German sessions very difficult. Well, back in those days, I guess we're talking about 60s, 70s, you know, I even recorded Downtown in German. Now, you wouldn't have to do that, you know, if Lady Gaga has a hit with something, you want to hear the original version. And you know, Lady Gaga's not going to sing in German or French or Italian unless she really wants to. But in those days, we had to.
There was a pop music movement in Paris in the 60s called the Yeye Girls. How involved in the movement were you?
Well, this was the French reaction to what was going on in England, I suppose. And it was Johnny Hallyday, Sylvie Vartan, Françoise Hardy, Sheila, and I was there too. You know, I think for certainly at the beginning, I was the closest thing to a rock and roll singer, you know, because, and I was English, you know, I had this accent which the others didn't have. And you know, I could sing. I had been brought up, I guess, on swing, on certainly on jazz, and yes, sort of rock and roll, although I wasn't a huge rock and roll fan at the beginning. You know, I didn't enjoy Bill Haley and that kind of thing. I thought there wasn't enough music in it, you know. But that kind of music was in me. It was part of me, and it wasn't part of the French idea of music. In fact, rock and roll was banned on French radio for a long time. Johnny was the first big, and he still is the biggest star in France. That's an amazing career. But my husband, who was like a jazz guy, and he put on the first rock and roll festival in France, which really put Johnny on the map.
Since you are part of pop culture, things have changed considerably. You are part of a big social movement at that time. What do you think of the female vocalists of today?
Well, you know, they're good singers, too. Beyoncé is actually a great singer. But a lot of her appeal is, of course, about sexuality, without a doubt. I've never really been that. And funny, I was being interviewed recently in France, and we went on, somehow the subject got on to that. And I said, well, you know, well, I've never been sexy, then sex has never been my thing. And this interviewer said, what? Mais oui, tu es sexy. Not really. And I said, well, it depends what you mean by sexy. You know, if sexy means taking your clothes off and gyrating and all that kind of thing, no, I've never done that. Sexy is to do with your attitude, I suppose, and it also depends on the songs. But you know, I'm a female. We all have these things inside us. We have all these feelings inside us. If I have a song, even Fever, you know, is kind of a sexy song, I'm not going to sing it like some cute little girl. You know, yeah. I know what that is. I know what that feels like.
Since I asked you about Aznavour, I have to ask you about Serge Gainsbourg. I mean, as a woman, can you tell me what was his sexual appeal?
I always thought Serge Gainsbourg was sexy. You know, he's that ugly, sexy thing, which has to do with intelligence, attitude, there again. And the way he was writing his songs had a lot of sexuality in them. And I was a fan when I first met him. I was quite nervous about meeting him. And he came to the apartment in Paris where I was living, and he was there to present a song to me. And he was very, very shy. He was nervous about meeting me too. So the two of us sat there for about 5 minutes without saying much. And then to break the ice, I said, would you like something to drink? He said, oh, oui. And I said, cup of tea? He said, no. I said, how about a beer? Oui, yes, a beer. So I brought a beer in and I had a beautiful grand piano, and he was going to play this song for me. And he was so nervous, he knocked the beer over into my piano. That never does it much good, you know. Beer in a piano is not good. And anyway, he went through the song. And afterwards, he went back to his publisher and he said, "That's it. She's never going to do any of my... nothing. She won't have anything to do with me. I've just ruined her grand piano." But I did sing the song. And he went on to write me quite a few. And I always liked him. Of course, he changed. He changed his image from that first time I met him. And then he became this iconic, kind of slightly weird person. But he never lost his talent.
Petula, thank you again for joining us. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Not at all. I enjoyed it.
Petula, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you again for listening to Popstar Conversations. Be sure to click the subscribe button below and hit the red bell so that you'll be notified of our next exclusive interview.
Thank you for listening to Popstar Conversations. Please join us again for another conversation with your favorite musical artist.